Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
This is an ESO and Dude Letter production. Welcome to Mission Briefing. Hi, everyone. We're back, finally. I know it's been weird and time has been off, but don't worry. It's now time to actually talk a little bit more about, well, our favorite Roger Moore. Wait, what movie are we doing? So just as we're getting into him, he's gone again. Well, here's the thing. When I first started thinking about doing this as a podcast, this one, A View to a Kill, was one of the motivating factors. It's one of the ones I'd forgotten about the most, as hopefully many of you have, because it's pretty bad. But also, it's one of those things that, well, of the Bond movies, it's the one that's going to be a bad movie podcast episode. And while Pierce Brosnan is part of my youth, this one is definitely one of the worst movies ever made. It's weird, it's silly, it's influenced by everything from, you know, Blues Brothers through weird action movies, and it's the one that makes almost no sense as a Bond movie. And then, of course, finally, when How Did This Get Made did it, June was focused completely on butterflies, and we talk about the butterflies and how baffling they are, but we give regular credence to how weird of a rest of the movie this actually is. So with acknowledgement of our competition, let me bring you A View to a Kill.
My name is Dan Carroll. I invite you to listen to Seriously Dan. We start out as a podcast with a focus on love, encouragement, and practical advice, and we quickly found the best way to do all of that is to celebrate the amazing folks within our community.
It sounds fascinating.
It is, because my cool friends do cool stuff.
I kind of need a minder, somebody to keep me on track, somebody to poke me with a stick when I get rambling.
I think you're right. Oh darn, this is going to be really great.
And we're going to be talking about those social problems that geeks face.
www.seriouslydan.com, www.seriouslydan.com. It's what all the kids are talking about these days.
Yes, it's consuming my life.
And you can find us now on iTunes.
Now, everybody, come on! Keeping inside.
Welcome to Mission Briefing. This week we watched Roger Moore's last movie, 1985's A View to a Kill.
Hooray!
Yeah. Yeah. Hooray, he's gone.
Mercifully.
There's so much odd sex that shouldn't have been in this movie, and so much we needed to survive through. This might be the first non-recommend of a Bond movie. I guess we'll go around the table and see if that turns out to be true. But we should go around the table and introduce yourselves. I'm Nick Hoffman, editor of Dude Letter and Myopia Defend Your Childhood. And on panel we have...
Steve-O.
Tom Herman of the Brothers Herman.
And David Herman, a.k.a. Reminiscence of the Brothers Herman.
Thomas... Go back. What's your podcast?
Oh, Thomas Herman of the Geekly Oddcast and the Brothers Herman.
Thank you.
I'm John, not of the Brothers Herman.
Hello, this is Daniel, and I think Grace Jones is a very sexy man.
There we go.
And I'm out.
And we're done.
This is a weird one, and...
That's what Grace Jones said, too.
There was grandpa sex.
Is there a single thing we could say about this movie that you can't follow with? That's what Grace Jones said too.
Probably not. We'll see though.
I do want to say said is a strong thing because she has maybe four lines in this movie. Well,
to be fair, they're some of the best lines in the movie.
No. When she actually got going, it was great.
It's more lines than Dolph Lundgren.
That's more lines than Dolph Lundgren. Yeah. It's more lines than Odd Job.
He's a dolphin, apparently.
Yeah, no, that was all.
No, he's Dolph Lundgren.
Dolphin Lundgren, yes.
All right, so before we get too far into this, of course, we need to do our cold open scene, which makes no sense, but James Bond invents snowboarding.
Out of a helicopter.
Is
this the first time your cold open scene has been a pun?
Don't think so, no, but I'm going with it.
Technically speaking, the Beach Boys invented snowboarding.
Who was featured in this?
God.
This is, that's right up there within, I believe it's Die Another Day, where they play London Calling when he arrives in London.
That is true.
Yes, that is true.
But, and it kind of goes completely against when Sean Connery like was making fun of pop culture and the Beatles.
To be fair, this song, though, is 20 years old by this point.
Truth.
The Beatles were contemporary.
Well, London Calling was like, what, 30 years old at that point?
This is bad. This is literally the worst sound cue we've had so far.
I remember the boos that happened during that sound cue.
It's not as bad as You Only Do It Better in Barbershop Quartet, wasn't it?
Oh, nobody does it better.
Yeah.
Where it turns into like a
chorus line
from 1940s Broadway.
Better.
No, yeah. No, it's not a song cue, guys. We need to get through this.
We should turn it into a song cue.
Please, no.
So we essentially have a downhill sledding scene, which is very clear that Roger Moore never left Pinewood Studios.
No.
We see him in a different color snowbank than the entire rest of the scene is shot in.
That's the entire movie. That's just foreshadowing, really.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah, downhill is just foreshadowing,
Everyone else is on a snowfield, and he's on a Star Trek set.
Yes, it is. apparently what's happening is question mark. Well, we have a dead guy in the snow, which is 003, and Bond finds a microchip, or as Q says, the microchip, Mr. Bond.
Oh, yeah.
Which is blue because he's dead in the snow. Remember. What happens is...
This is an important plot point.
Somehow.
No, it's not.
Because it doesn't connect to literally anything else.
No, it's not. Stop lying.
Here's the problem. So many cold opens are the end of the previous case. This time, they think, we're going to tie it to the rest of the movie. But... it makes no sense. The movie is the dumbest plot, and I'll splice in somewhere around here, probably after we get about halfway through John's plot synopsis.
I guarantee this is going to be short.
Yes. Roger Ebert's review, where he calls Matt Zorn the most brilliantly acted worst Bond villain of all time.
Oh, this is going to devolve into bad Christopher Walken impersonations.
Indeed. I promise I won't be doing any of those.
I'm going to try not to, but it's going to happen. But I'll just make it sound like I ran out of thoughts.
Oh, you sound like...
is a gap in your sentence.
I was about to say, I'm going to try not to, but it's going to happen. Isn't that Bond on his first date?
Boo! Okay. But regardless, this turns into a skiing scene where, again, after the snowmobile explodes, we end up with the creation of snowboarding, which probably existed, but...
maybe.
For a long time, actually.
Yeah, this is 85, so it was probably an underground thing.
No, actually, snowboarding's... fairly old, actually.
Like,
it goes back a ways. It's just came into the popular vogue more recently.
I do believe that it's the first time white English people saw it.
Probably. Well, yeah. I mean, it was... okay, English people, yes, you went on that one.
I know that looking at it from this point of view, we kept running into this where Bond had one of his skis damaged, and we kept wondering, when is he just going to turn to the side and start snowboarding with that one ski?
I actually preferred the scenes where he just has one ski as... but it's still pretending like he can ski.
Yeah.
It's like using a piece of exploded snowmobile.
That has foot clips.
Exactly, yeah.
Regardless, at this point he skis down the mountain, ends up saving the day, and ends up in a iceberg that happens to be a submarine with a woman in it.
And the British flag is on the cover, yeah.
That's how you know it's, you know...
British flag is on a hatch on the Doghead Rock submarine.
And I like to think that the bad guys, which I assume are Russian at the time, are not at all surprised that the British have just gone along claiming icebergs at this point and putting the Union Jack on literally everything of theirs.
That's what we did for the previous 100 years. Why wouldn't it apply now?
Yeah, keeping the British end up.
I've got a question for you, John. I've got a question for you, John, speaking of that. Is there like a hatch in the Falkland Islands that you just open it and it's the Union Jack?
And inside is Prince Charles.
Well, really, they're just goats that are painted that way.
Oh, I see.
For strategic sheep purposes.
Goats that are painted like the Union Jack or goats that are painted like Prince Charles?
He is a goat painted like Prince Charles. Talk about keeping your end up. This gets us directly into a Duran Duran song.
It is. You know what?
He's welching on the deal, right?
Screw what everyone says. This is an awesome song.
And it's actually not a bad music video part.
Yeah.
The blacklight effect is pretty good. A woman undresses a onesie, and inside is the 007 tattoo.
That was so campy.
It was so campy.
It was an interesting scene. It was kind of artsy, but it felt like one of those stories you start telling and you realize it sucks and you think, it sounded so much better in my head. It just did not project
once you
for
get
me.
To the girl
so they add lasers.
And you have a girl who's like
shit, so a T-Rex showed up and she had huge tits.
Yeah.
She's more like dancing.
She's sashaying.
She was like skiing.
She's dancing
on fire,
into the fire.
Which is infuriating because other than the opening scene, there's no skiing in this movie.
And almost yet, no music.
Half the music video was them skiing.
Yes, that is a great point. There's barely any music in this movie.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, this is also kind of classic of this 80s and 90s era of the music video portion, because it's literally like, what's the first 5 minutes? I can't be bothered to watch the rest of this movie. It's not until the more recent era with, like, the Adele song where it's, like, the theme throughout.
So what you're saying is Duran Duran was smarter than the rest of us.
Duran Duran is smarter than most of this movie.
Yeah.
I was talking about us personally, who actually did sit through the movie.
Most likely also true.
I mean, this is also, I think, the first Bond song to reach number one right away. Mm-hmm. And
is it still the only one to reach number one?
I thought the Adele song did, but I could be wrong.
I don't know.
I don't know if that reached number one, but it's...
This is not worth looking up.
No, it's not.
Although it is good to have a highlight of the movie in the first 5 minutes.
Well, it means you get to shut the movie off after 5 minutes and you've seen everything that you need to see.
To be fair, with this movie, that's probably a benefit.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, most of it would have done better with either the... We actually kept humming the theme from Blues Brothers throughout the car crash sequence.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's a lot of very Bond doing Blues Brothers in this, which is weird to say. But before we go much further off the rails, John, you should give us the plot summary.
No.
Good reaction.
So we get out of the... This is going to be a quick plot summary because I really can't be asked to go through all the convoluted nothingness that was this movie. But, so we get out of the cold open.
You mean the butterfly dance had nothing to do with the plot?
Did the horses?
Believe it or not, they didn't.
But there was a callback and everything.
It didn't matter. None of it mattered.
But they found the steroids.
But there was a hot tub scene, and everyone knows that any hot tub scene in a Bond movie must be important.
But...
It didn't matter. None of it mattered.
But the mother from that 70s show was in this movie.
That didn't matter. That mattered very much.
Not the main character's mom, someone else.
Because this is where we find out that 70s show is actually in the same universe as the James Bond universe.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. That
puts a whole different spin on everything.
Oh, no, it's not Ashton Kutcher's mom.
No.
Oh, my God, it would be great if he was the spawn of a Bond character.
I can say now that we've all been punked.
Oh, my God, that would have been great.
Wouldn't it, though?
No, it wouldn't have.
It's better than this movie, though. All right, so we're
scraping the bottom of the barrel, looking for plot. Please continue.
We're actually finding better plot, just making things up, than this movie actually had. So we're back in London after the cold open.
Yeah.
They're comparing the microchip that Bond found on 003 with the Russians.
On a TV.
With some other microchip coming from somewhere. They're identical. Mm-hmm. So the assumption, or the plot, as Q explains to us, is that the Russians are counterfeiting microchips. Because
profit? They've got a mole.
I guess. We don't know why, but we do know that this microchip was made by Zorin Industries, which had only just been acquired by Zorin, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so, obviously, Zorin is the first stop to make to determine why or where this leak is coming from. I would have thought the Russians would have been the first stop, but apparently the industrialist is.
You're right, actually.
Yeah, it's the same Moonraker plot.
It's a stupid plot hole.
It's the same Moonraker plot. Shuttle goes missing. Let's investigate the guy who created the shuttle.
I'm actually more pissed off now. There shouldn't have even been a line like, all right, we'll send 009 to investigate the Russians or something. And Bond just happens to be on the right path. But no, it makes no sense. You're right. No. We're done 10 minutes in.
And also, then we get to the other part that makes no sense, which is the first act of this movie, which is all about horse racing using Zorin's horses. We're in the French chateaus, like Versailles, very extravagant. Bond and John Steed from the Avengers are going undercover to determine what the hell is going on. Meanwhile, wait. The audience is left to do the same thing.
Wait. That was John Steed from the Avengers?
That was John Steed from
the Avengers. Oh, my God.
Well,
no.
What's her name from?
Patrick McNee. Yeah.
The woman from the Avengers.
Dinah Rigg.
She was the Bond girl two movies ago.
Yeah. On Her Majesty's Secret Service, wasn't that when she was the Bond girl?
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, she was the
movies
wife.
Ago.
She was the wife.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh. Yep.
So, anyway,
she's on Game of Thrones now, for anybody who's keeping track.
Ugh. Yeah, she's one of the few people still alive.
This
yeah.
is our 14th Bond movie.
It feels like it. So anyway, horses. Zoran is using microchips to make his horses faster. He used to be a KGB, but he was also a Nazi baby.
I'm going to get more whiskey. Yeah.
How does that work? Did they ever explain how that worked?
The Nazi the med, babies or the shit?
The Nazi baby.
Right. The mad doctor was a Nazi who was experimenting on pregnant women during the... I guess the implication is in concentration
camps. No, they said in concentration camps.
Oh, wait,
it was explicit.
The mad doctor was actually part of that? I never caught that.
So, yeah. And so he was experimenting on women in concentration camps with... question mark?
Trying to make super babies.
And he was making super babies, and some of the few that survived were very intelligent, but also incredibly crazy.
Psychotic.
Plus, he's just because the Russians got to them, Nazi baby.
Because the Russians got to them, the Russians took the doctor and Zoran and made them spies or whatever.
It's a better Doctor Who plot that the Russians got the doctor and they're trying to make some sort of clone program.
I'm actually just picturing like a Nazi that talks like Christopher Walken, and it's very satisfying.
Yes, Christopher Walken is the bad guy in this.
Yes, yes, he is.
The first Academy Award-winning actor to be in a Bond movie, and he's in some ways the best part, but not given almost anything to do.
Yeah, that is the thing. And by the way, if you're looking for a reason to see this movie, Christopher Walken being a Bond villain is the best reason you're going to get.
Or literally how we watched it to drink and talk over, because this is not one you need to see again on the big screen for the first. No. This is atrocious.
I remember in previous movies sitting there taking, like, you know, detailed notes and really, like, paying attention to all of the little minutiae, and this one I'm just, like, out of hell with it.
Oh, you and me. You and me were having
one
fun.
Been doing this. That's why I'm given the plot synopsis, because I'm just a glutton for...
Well, and you take notes, like... Every time I take notes, like, we have the worksheet, it's online.
I'll get lost.
Yeah, no, it is. I just have this sheet, and I'm just, like, sadness. I start drawing, like, angry faces.
Progressively more angry
faces. That happened a lot with the Roger Moore era, didn't it?
Well, but the thing is, Roger Moore is really a fun movie. It's by definition, they're supposed to be fun movies, but at this point, like, he doesn't even seem to be enjoying it.
No.
There's no quips,
there are infuriating.
There's no joy. This is a joyless Bond movie.
Because there are no gadgets. There's very little, like, over-the-top, maniacal, typical Bond stuff.
It reminded me of Adam West making those PSAs in the 70s still as Batman. That's really what this was. It was, like,
it
was sad.
They have the same haircut, too.
Yeah, they do. It was very sad. It was very sad.
So we should walk back through this. This movie is nothing but fits and starts and scenes from various books that don't exist. Because, like...
That is one of the most intelligent things I've ever heard here.
And by the way, have we actually finished the synopsis? And I'm not asking that as a correction.
No, I'm
saying that because I don't know.
We'll get to it as we get to it, but, like, you guys have to understand.
This bottle in front of us.
You know how when your grandmother asks you to fix her email, you don't want to deal with it? That's how this movie deals with technology. There are microchips, and they're making horses faster by injecting them into its legs.
Oh, and by the way, a little piece of fridge logic. Since that is the only thing we ever see those microchips doing, presumably the microchip found in Siberia was from a rogue horse that ran off and died in Siberia.
Another Grace Jones?
We're going to be making a lot of Grace Jones jokes here.
Because she's the only thing we're talking about.
Yes, she is.
She's a completely believable henchwoman. In fact,
she is a really good henchwoman.
If you wanted to cast this movie, there's no way you could convince me that Chris Walken as the brains and then her as the brawn aren't a great movie.
Mm.
And then they gave us this script and they're just like, fuck it, I guess.
I mean, the two of them could have had plenty of charisma or play off each other that you've got the brains and the brawn. You've got the, what was it from Thunderdome? You've got
Tina Turner?
No.
You mean you don't have Tina Turner?
You've got Master Blaster.
Oh.
Yes.
You've got the brain and the brawn.
And there's even a sexual karate scene in here.
But they never play off each other.
No.
They're almost always in like separate scenes in separate places. And
spoiler alert, Chris Walken tries to kill Grace Jones at the end.
Which is why she turns good?
For like two scenes?
Get away. I don't know why she sacrifices herself.
Because she had to hold the
another
break.
Spoiler alert.
I guess. Oh, spoiler alert for a goddamn movie as old as I am. It came out the year
I haven't finished the plot, Nick.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
We'll get there when we get there.
Speaking of, this is 85 and Marty McFly walks through a scene, which is
weird.
With
the doctor.
With the doctor.
With Doc. Brown.
No, it would be better if it was the doctor.
It
was
John McGowan at this time, 85?
It would Colin Baker.
Colin Baker, there we go.
85?
Time Traveler.
Yeah, just it would be transferring from Davis to Baker.
Time Traveler. It could have been David Tennant. It was 19.
No,
like
it would be Baker,
doctor,
yeah.
Didn't he? With the long white hair?
Oh, yeah. William Hartnell.
He also looked like Colonel Klink. With his monocle.
With his monocle, yeah. It's all CGI'd in.
So Mengele was the co-star of the villain.
He would have been a good villain.
Mengele a villain. As an Englishman.
You already have the Nazi kind of undertones. You may as well have the Nazi doctor as a villain. He was good in X-Men First Class.
I mean,
he'd be good in this.
I don't read a lot of, like, internet forums, but, like, was this a year some sort of, like, I don't know, Operation Paperclip shit came out? Because this is literally concentration camp experiments become Bond villains. Like, this is a really bleak plot that turns into, like, a slapstick, like, Blues Brothers scene. Like, this is
where's
insane.
Matt Quinn when you need him?
Well, that's the thing.
Let me check TV tropes!
Oh, be nice.
All right, well,
that's his line.
I know.
Okay, so here's the question. If you had, like, this really bleak subject matter and you wanted it to not be a bleak movie, who would you have casted other than who we got?
For 1985?
Mm-hmm.
The Syrians! They found me, Marty!
Well, that was Bolivians.
Bolivians!
Run, Marty. They found me. I don't know how, but they found me. Run, Marty!
That's actually pretty damn good.
Yeah, that was actually pretty good.
Can we watch that
movie? Huey Lewis! Because he was actually the teacher who said their band was too loud.
Too damn loud.
That was actually Huey Lewis.
That was Huey Lewis.
With the horn rims on, yeah. I don't know, who would be good? Actually, you know what? If it wasn't Grace Jones, Dolph Lundgren would have been fine. In fact, Dolph Lundgren could have played the part because he is a physicist and could have used the words better than Chris Walken.
And he actually has a Russian accent, so the KGB link would make sense.
I mean, he didn't say it, but he would, despite the fact that he's actually smart, he would be more like Christmas Jones.
Yes.
Ooh. He looks too good to be the part.
Well, and he can't act.
that's the thing.
There's that, too. He's exactly like Christmas
Jones. We said this earlier, and... Well, at least I said this. The Bond girl in this movie was way less convincing than Christmas Jones.
Also, absolutely.
I never would have believed Bond beating Dolph Lundgren in a fight.
No. Although that would be interesting as a Bond plot in the future, like an Expendable-style thing where it's like Jean-Claude Van Damme shows back up, the brains of it is Dolph, you know, like that. And keep them all European with their accents. Like, that's... Well, no, I mean, it's good. Like, you don't have to have... Like, no. Just... You need someone who sounds vaguely European. Mm-hmm. And for once, damn it, he can play his Belgian accent if it's Jean-Claude. He doesn't have to pretend to be, I am American, John Smith. Speaking of, St. John Smythe.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Bond's undercover name.
With his goddamn gray top hat. We're going to the farm today.
Pinky out. Pinky so far out.
We should stop here for a second and talk about Moneypenny, because this is the last time the actress who played Moneypenny is Moneypenny.
Oh, right? Grandma?
Exactly.
The grandma outfit she was wearing?
I will say, she gets a nice farewell, because Bond gives her a check for, what, $1 million? Because he's the only one who bets on Zorn. Zorn's horse wins.
Oh,
and he
gives
her the racing ticket.
That's
right,
yeah. It's office day out at the races.
Yes.
Actually, I do have a question, because I remember there's an important point on the Bond worksheet. And I didn't catch it, but it's also possible I just tuned out for that portion of the movie.
I doubt it.
I think I can be forgiven for that. Did Roger Moore ever say Bond, James Bond, in this movie?
Yes,
he did.
Once, he was to the cop.
Okay, that's right, he did. That's right, there it was. Okay,
it was there.
And now I'm Dick Tracy.
Are you really Bond, James Bond? He goes, yes, I'm Bond, James Bond of British intelligence. And you're just like, all right. But we don't get a gun barrel sequence.
No, you don't.
No, we don't.
You don't get a lot of sequels.
No, instead, what we got was Roger Moore pointing a gun at the screen and getting a series of red concentric circles in a very 1980s computer animated moment.
It was awesome, in other words, is what he's trying to say. It was awesome. Oh,
man. It was awesome in the 80s, and then every generation after that has looked at it and gone, oh, what were we thinking?
Okay, so I referenced earlier that when they're at the stables, which we might never talk about this movie in plots, but that's fine. okay. Marty McFly walks by wearing jeans and a red vest and a t-shirt. Yeah, there you go. It looks like Marty McFly's character type. So it would be great if Q had an intern working on the computers, and it was Matthew Broderick from War Games. This is 85.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was 83. Why not actually get Kevin Mitnick?
There you go. Or I mean, anything. Get the guy from the Wizard.
Fred Savage?
We could have had Val Kilmer from Real Genius in this and had fun with him. I mean...
Really? Better! Better! If you're going to go shitty campy movie?
So what we're saying is when we're looking for people we could have cast in this movie, there actually is a huge depth to make this, you know, the silly movie to offset the concentration camp.
If the CIA's Q was Adam West as Batman, right? We have for you some carousel reversal spray. Like, this will make everything look like a soft-shell crab, because that's apparently the code word on Pier 39.
Q doesn't do shit in this movie. There are no gadgets.
No, he watches Bond getting laid in a shower.
There's a sharper image. Yeah.
Oh, that's slimmer.
Right. That's right. That's the only gadget.
That's
you're
the
right.
The only gadget. Sharper image. It's like a window opener credit card.
No, there was one gadget, and Roger Moore talked about it in his autobiography. Nick, you want to take that one?
Okay.
Gizmos and gadgets and odds and ends. So apparently, Roger Moore had a bad tendency to goose the Bond girls, where he'd pinch their butts when they're doing sex scenes, and it was just known. So apparently, Grace Jones found out about this probably through Dolph Lundgren. And so when they have their very awkward, elbowy sex scene, where... they edited out a bunch of it because apparently they clearly didn't like each other. There's grimaces of disgust even when they're acting towards each other. And so Grace Jones lifts up the sheets, buck naked, and then they cut out all the in-between of her actually getting into bed. But apparently hidden under the pillows is a giant black rubbery dildo. And so when she gets on top of Bond, she jams him in the ass. And if you look at the screen, you can see him all of a sudden, like, his face changes. His face drops and his eyes grow. And then he has to kind of finish acting with a smirk on his face because apparently half his ass fell asleep.
Now, are we sure that wasn't Roger Moore's dildo?
Well, according to his biography, he prefers only Irish dildos.
Ah.
And this was a large black dildo. Dolph, from the Dolph Lundgren collection, number 3.
Vintage.
Again, Grace Jones might literally be the best as Mayday and on the screen. This is also John Glenn's last movie as a Bond director, too, I think.
I think you're right.
Who then went into space.
Yeah.
And became a senator.
Who had directed The Living Daylights?
I think someone else. Yeah, someone who was pro pro Afghanistan.
So, what happened after the whole horse stable thing? Because
we haven't even explained the horse thing.
No, we haven't.
Okay, so Bond is there as Mr. St. John Smythe to pretend to buy a horse. It's like a horse auction.
Of course.
So, Zorin has all his horses up for auction at the Versailles, whatever. Bond's cover is he's there to buy a horse. Zorin figures out he's 007 using his fancy computer.
Oh, is that the apple that they show for like one scene?
Yeah, this is another apple. Yeah,
the one that like is 12 inches.
This is almost as crazy as in Moonraker, where he calls up the henchman hotline and orders Jaws.
Yeah,
Zorin just like types into his computer like St. John Smythe, brown hair, brown eyes, whatever, and it comes back James Bond, 007, License to Kill.
Yeah,
and he's just over the moon with this. He's just crazy good. He's, oh, this will be fun. So he takes Bond on and he throws Bond into a, pond?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He's dead. And Bond survived.
A couple things we should get to. This movie makes no sense. No. And I apologize in advance. So there's two scenes that happened before this. First of all, Bond ends up with a contact in the Eiffel Tower. Mm-hmm. After, well, I mean, we're introduced to Zorin because of a horse race, and the horse race is supposed to just be a cover. They're watching Zorin because we just want to see Zorin, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's really what it's supposed to be, but his horse wins by an incredible length. So Bond is suspicious, everyone's suspicious. We don't know why he's suspicious, other than the fact that one of the richest men in Europe has a fast horse. But you got to get to the plot somehow.
You would think that's not Secret Service stuff. That just cheating at horse racing is not.
But again, that's the kind of thing where it should literally be. I want you to see this guy. Here's a subtle way to meet him, mm-hmm. like Goldeneye, or sorry, like Goldfinger, yeah. Where they're literally at the pool and there's a guy cheating at poker. It makes perfect sense.
And he's like a smuggler or something.
Yes.
It's like, why are you including Secret Service in this?
And yet, that's how we leave Miss Moneypenny forever. And we move on to a new actress.
Dressed as a cake.
What about now, was that before or after that restaurant Eiffel Tower scene?
No, that's the next scene.
Oh, okay.
Next okay. Scene. Yeah. And so, I mean, segue. Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome.
We end up in what is actually... Okay, so at the top of the Eiffel Tower is a restaurant. We've all been there. The Jules Verne. But this is a scene out of what? I said Great Gatsby, but it's out of a steampunk nightmare. I had expected giants. Yes. Where a man is comparing wine knowledge with Bond, and Bond is winning. Just.
Well, it doesn't matter because Bond's paying the bill.
Exactly, yeah.
That's true.
I'll order whatever you want as long as you're paying.
And then we end up with the weirdest scene ever, the Dance of the Papillon, which is the paper butterflies, in which a woman who is... flailing randomly into the air in front of a symphony.
And whistling.
She's has a Snow bunch White, of paper basically. Butterflies.
Yeah.
Which, if you watch a lot of Bond movies, the Broccolis like to have things that exist. You know, they go to carnival and they...
Really?
And they go to, like, actually see real performers perform. And when they were in India in the last movie, they had an actual tennis star. Like, with a tennis racket who was batting away grenades, because that's what happens. Fine. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure this was an actress in Paris who actually did a dance routine. Probably not in the Eiffel Tower, because that restaurant is probably smaller than the room we recorded. However, it's stupid as hell, because men with fishing rods dancing around get knocked out by Grace Jones, who then kills someone with a fish hook in the neck.
It's the same fishing rods that we later see supporting the blimp prop that they use.
Very clearly out of Deep 13.
Mm.
Thank you, nerds.
Again, she would have had to have prepared a poisonous paper butterfly on a hook, on a fishing line,
mm-hmm.
dress in black,
mm-hmm.
and preempt this whole meeting that was going on, which she didn't actually know about.
Yeah, are you telling me you've never done that before?
Am
I the only one?
This is Jaws 4 all over again.
I was about to say, I call that Thursday. What's wrong with you?
You've never preemptively prepared a paper butterfly?
I'm going to defend John here. Usually I use paper birds.
Oh.
I'll grant you. Okay, that's fair.
Origami birds or just...
I like the idea, too, that we assumed it's poisonous. There's no evidence for that. No.
Well,
there's literally just a hook in his neck like he was a fish that was thrown there.
At the time, we don't know, but they do allude to this when they're inspecting the microchips and Bond is kind of inferring the technology.
Is there a microchip in the butterfly?
There was. No, there really was.
Because
later Bond says, well, these microchips, you see how they got this injector, and this is how they inject the drugs into the horse, and you could put this in a cane or a whip.
Or a fishing rod.
Oh
my god.
Or a butterfly.
Much better movie if all of a sudden people started dropping dead halfway through it.
Well, at that point, your villain's the Joker.
And Chris Walken is a psychotic Joker? Yeah. I'd buy it in a second.
All right.
This is 4 years before the Tim Burton Joker.
Yeah, indeed. But of course, Christopher Walken didn't get in on the Batman movies until the second one, so Joker was out of the...
Shit, it's the same act. It's the same character.
It really is.
Max Schreck? Or
Shrek.
Shrek. So from now on, we'll just refer to the villain of this Bond movie as Max Schreck.
I'm fine with that.
Hey, and Grace Jones's donkey.
People have survived falling off the Golden Gate Bridge before. Why not him?
Why not him? We know he's a super mutant.
That makes so much sense.
I wish Grace Jones came back like Jaws did.
Oh, that would have been awesome. Yeah.
God, half cybernetic too. Like she was wearing a turban.
Yeah. deliberately murdering all of the people who previously encountered Jaws through some kind of voodoo curse.
Oh my god.
Well, I think
She's good. Like she's a tall, strong character. Like you're like really like she's a terrifying character. Yep. And Bond, I mean, at this point, geriatric Bond cannot throw a punch.
Now
even.
She's taller than Roger Moore, right?
Clearly.
Yeah. Okay,
yes.
I was about to say it's like. It was like mother and son in some of those scenes.
Well, considering the first time we see her at the horse track, she's dressed like some sort of like black
she's dressed
cardinal
like,
type.
She's like dressed she has like Gina from Star Trek.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah,
she is.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. And like, but the hat is even taller. Somehow.
It is. Like, it's like a pointy
it's literally like
hat.
A bishop, like a black bishop and, character on a chessboard. Because it's like.
And may I just say, she was the wrong person to dress like that because we did in fact have a woman named Jenny Flex.
Oh my god!
Is that the worst Bond character name ever?
I do think it is.
It's a name that we really didn't need to be introduced as.
It's like Pussy Galore. At least is subtle. Yeah. Like
no, it's not.
It's even worse that subtle. She has no part to play other than saying hi, I'm Jenny Flex, and then dying.
And if you guys don't know this movie, she plays the Nazi woman in Temple of Doom. No, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Last Crusade, right?
Crusade,
yeah.
The one who goes back for the Grail and then dies in the pit.
The one who talks in her sleep.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Which stars Sean Connery, who was in what movie with Kevin Bacon?
All the Bond movies. You mean who was in all the Bond movies? Like,
exactly,
literally.
Yeah.
With Kevin Bacon.
Yeah. With Kevin Bacon, yeah.
That's kind of why I like watching. If you guys want to play the other version of the game, watch all the Pinewood movies because they have the same. Like, I'm sure half of these Nazis, half of these Germans were Nazis in Indiana Jones movies and stormtroopers in the Star Wars movies because it's all like.
It's the same cast.
No, the main villain in Last Crusade was the AT pilot in Empire Strike Back.
And he was one of the German guys in one of the Bond movies we did not long ago. We've done 14 of these, guys.
Yeah.
I drink through a lot of them. I'm a professor.
Progressively so.
And you're a professor. Professor. Doctor.
Oh,
just
doctor?
No, an engineer.
Yeah. Engineer. Yeah.
Fine.
Where do we go from here?
Well, after they belay out of the Eiffel Tower, and then he steals half a car.
No, it gets early. Cut in half,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Also,
he steals a full car.
Yeah.
He steals a full car, but he returns a half car.
It's like a quarter of a car,
it's
really.
It's one of those scenes where Bond predicts the future because it really looks like a scene out of Top Gear.
And then they ruin a movie. And they ruin the movie, but they ruin a wedding.
Yes.
Which also hasn't been the movie.
Some of the cake survived that he fell.
Which it gives
some,
to
yes,
the
he does.
Arrested by the chefs. I love it. Like the chefs with their chef knives just take him by the arms and walk him away.
Oh, chefs have full power of arrest. Did
you
know that?
Yeah, you do not mess with
that's
chefs
like
in France.
Yes.
There was a reference in the next scene.
Yeah.
You caused $5 million of damage and violated half of the Napoleonic Code.
That was the whole deal with Swedish Chef. That was actually a number station going on.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
Back to conspiracy theory. Welcome to Last Podcast on the Left, guys. Although I do like the idea that the English just got him out of prison because it's the Napoleonic Code, and if there's one place that the Napoleon didn't get, it's England.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah. Just on a matter of principle.
Yeah. And then we end up with the Q scene, which is garbage, because Bond has his Walther, but it doesn't get used. It literally gets taken by the San Fran PD.
There was a Q scene in this movie?
Yeah, he's the one who does the microchips and then watches
Bond
get laid.
Okay. I was wondering if that was like the first, second, or third time I went
to
use
Q
the restroom.
No, it's not the Q scene you expect.
There wasn't a gadget.
Yeah.
So there wasn't anything for
Please,
Q to expect.
Yeah. There's a gadget. It's K9.
That's right.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Which we only really get in the final scene.
We get it twice. There was that earlier scene.
It's introduced that it's used.
Yeah, it's introduced.
Chekhov's K9.
Exactly.
It is the worst example of a Chekhov's gun I've ever heard of. Oh, yeah. It comes back after the entire plot's been resolved, just so we can see the Bond sex scene at the very end.
You forget the boxes, literally boxes filled of loose microchips. Where it's just like, my God, microchips. And he's like running his hands through it like Scrooge McDuck in gold coins.
It's a treasure chest full of...
What, you've never envisioned Q diving and swimming through a sea of microchips before?
Maybe you haven't.
I mean, I imagine him with K9 just watching, like literally filming his own pornography.
Which gets us to the plot.
Sex dungeon?
Yes. That... microchips. That Zorn is stockpiling microchips, and he's creating a cartel on microchips for his plan to completely destroy Silicon Valley.
Don't interrupt him, Thomas.
So,
I'm going to see where this goes.
So I'm working on very thin ice. I recognize this.
I let you finish.
He wants to flood Silicon Valley via earthquake of the San Andreas Fault so that he and his cartel can have complete ownership or corner of the market on microchips.
Mm-hmm.
ignoring the whole Russian thing, that's the plot.
I want to point out, I really need to point out, you just managed to summarize 2/3 to 3/4 of the movie in less than 30 seconds.
You're welcome.
It sounded like a negotiation. Here's the plot. Take it or leave it. We're not budging.
Yeah. This is like Chevy Chase and Fletch when he goes, don't you know everything's up with ball bearings these days?
Right.
Exactly.
Well, the other thing is, too, the whole plot is introduced because there's a very specific kind of complicated microchip they developed that's EMP-proof, right? Right.
Which we get explained in GoldenEye, which is several movies hence.
Right. But even at the moment, he's like, if a nuclear weapon goes off in space, which the Russians could do at literally any moment, which we're threatened with.
Thanks, GoldenEye.
Right. these microchips won't be violated, and that's what was on 003, et cetera, et cetera. The fact that that's the component, we all thought that nuclear weapons would be used later as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
Or threatened.
This is, in fact, the exact opposite of a Chekhov's gun. Once you'd hear those chips described, they never really come back as anything other than a MacGuffin.
That's what I was going to say. It's not a Chekhov's gun. It's a MacGuffin, which is Chekhov's mentally ill brother.
Yeah.
MacGuffin Chekhov.
MacGuffin
on the starships. on the Starship Superprize.
MacGuffin.
MacGuffin's gun. I like it.
MacGuffin's gun.
MacGunfin's.
And that's the thing.
Is this the worst Bond? Not Roger Moore specifically, but he doesn't drink, he doesn't use the Walter, he has no gadgets, and he stumbles into a plot because he goes to see a horse race without a cucumber sandwich.
He does have one gadget. He has a tape recorder that he uses to pretend like he's snoring.
But he gets to pretend he also has
conversations with Patrick McNee.
Oh yeah,
like 5 hours.
And may I just say that sort of sets up and completely fails to set up for one of the most bizarre sequences of scenes in the movie, where it starts out with Grace Jones and Christopher Walken having a fight scene that ends with Christopher Jones forcing himself on Grace Jones.
Christopher Jones?
Christopher Walken forcing himself on Grace Jones.
They become one after a certain point.
Well, yes. Only to realize that somehow, you know, someone's loose in the building going up to deal with Bond, to have Grace Jones specifically tell Christopher Walken, he's the guy on the Eiffel Tower, then to open her room, find that he's in her bed waiting, quote unquote, waiting for her, because that's his cover, and decide to get in bed with him while Christopher Walken decides to go downstairs.
Is this the only literal scene of getting in bed with the enemy?
In Bond? I don't think
no,
so.
No, not at all in Bond.
But here's the only time it's really projected as... Because you almost expect Chris Walken to have, like, a cave where he watches Grace Jones have sex. Like, there's cameras everywhere. Like, it's really like, go ahead. Like, he's like kind of...
Can you imagine Chris Walken with his own Batcave?
I imagine
it's
it would
like under the
literally every day.
Seriously, yeah. Christopher Walken preferring to watch is about the only motivation that would actually explain that sequence of events.
I'll do it. Oh yeah.
Literally.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
You're really doing it for me, baby.
I hate
he would all literally of you. Be. He'd literally be Chris running to go watch.
Aww. I see what you did there, and I don't like it.
I like it.
His verbal pace is walking the whole time, but he's running to go watch. Let's get moving.
I just want to point out, we went to the puns on Christopher Walken's name before we went to the major Christopher Walken impersonations. This is really impressive
this
on
is
our part.
Control. Yeah. I do like the idea that Dolph Lundgren was the one wearing that horrible Roger Moore wig to pull off that scene, but we know it wasn't based on his expressions.
We can only imagine.
Oh my God.
Did we get to the part where Grace Jones knocks that guy out of the blimp?
We should fast forward to that because nothing in between matters.
That's what kind of the plot is explored.
Well, that's the whole Goldfinger scene where he's like talking about destroying Silicon Valley.
Exactly that, yeah.
The only scene that in between matters is the next morning Bond is told by Zorin that Zorin has the perfect horse for him. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get the future technology.
Bond is seeing a man about a horse.
He's seeing a man about a horse, literally. And according to Tony Mendez, the guy who wrote Argo, that CIA agent, this technology was so impressive to his section chief that he demanded that Tony Mendez develop the face recognition technology that says literally "License to Kill" across it. Because apparently at that point, if you're upper management of the CIA,
the bureaucracy just hires people who watch Bond movies all day. I do like the idea.
I believe
that...
it. I really do. Like, if anything is going to propel government to, you know, get inventive, it's Hollywood.
And I mean, on one hand, you want to defend, like, the idea that we really did hire a bunch of, like, stage crew people to develop fake boats so that D-Day could work. Mm. But on the other hand, I like the idea that the head of the KGB literally sends him an Avengers box set, so he's watching the old 60s, or The Saint, right? And he's
just like,
my God, I need... like Mission Impossible technology to make a rubber mask out of a face instantly.
Well,
like,
that's why we have Guantanamo, because someone watched a prisoner.
Right, exactly right.
I am not a number. I'm a free man.
Which, wait, by the way, like the fourth or fifth episode of Mission Impossible actually had them kidnapping like a KGB agent and trying to convince him that he had been hit on the head and it was 5 years in the future and he was being interrogated by the KGB so that to prove that he had actually done good for the Russians. Now,
that's
seriously, it really is, and I want
to
know, what did the CIA do with that?
I wish you hadn't told me it was a plot from a show, because otherwise the CIA watches a lot of the Flintstones, and then a bowling ball hits him on the head. Also, it would have been great instead of the orange jumpsuits, they were wearing black suits from the prisoner in Gitmo. Like, that'd be, number 8, you're the most important. Like, it's just like...
Name is Ahmed.
How are all of these better movies?
I'm just picturing us sending, like, the KGB the most random movies to think that that's our technology. It's like, my God, they've developed the machine that goes pink. We must put all our efforts into this.
My God, it's full of stars.
Oh, no.
So you're saying we're in the Matrix.
Well, I mean, you know that...
Yuri.
Reagan got his Star Wars thing by watching Star Wars and saying, we need a space laser. Mm-hmm. You need a giant ball in space lasers on its head.
Well, you know, those people on Alderaan had it coming for a while now.
Can you imagine being the guy? And I'm
Mr. Emperor, tear down that planet.
Stripping away all the bullshit. Can you imagine being the guy on the CIA's or NSA's, like dole? Looking at YouTube videos to find the one guy who figured something out. Like, literally, like, being like, my God, it is a clip of Star Wars shooting an UFO.
There was a Mel Gibson movie, and I'm pretty sure it had Patrick Stewart in it.
Conspiracy theory?
Which was just that.
Yeah.
It was, Mel Gibson was one of these YouTubers, or what would be YouTubers.
It was, like, in the 90s,
yeah.
So he had a newsletter.
He had a newsletter. Yeah. Where he just had conspiracy theories, and one of his conspiracy theories happened to be correct, so he had to be taken out.
So he was just downloading The Spirit of Christmas from, like, South Park over and over again? Yeah. And just, yeah.
More than one, because he wasn't being taken... one of the ones he wasn't being taken out for was the idea that NASA was putting earthquake satellites in space, and that was actually... a little scene that they dropped towards the end says that that was true.
Really?
Yeah. Yes!
Mm. Well, I mean, it's just all these things. It's just like... Again, you watch enough videos about the gray aliens, and you're a bit, or David Icke and the reptilians, you're just gonna be like, "Wait a minute, I did get a flu shot! My God!" Like, eventually, you're gonna... which is a Simpsons plot line, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, we watched a Bond movie, but we shouldn't have.
Well, we definitely shouldn't have.
Where are we at this point in this movie?
Well, we're
almost to San Francisco.
Literally wherever Steve or John says we are, that's where we are now.
Let's go to San Francisco. All right.
Rock Salt San Francisco or Fire Truck San Francisco?
Fire Truck San Francisco.
First, we've got to use Grace Jones saying the title of this movie in the most groan-inducing scene.
What a view to a kill. Because she's playing this character.
Yeah.
This was one of the few films where the title made no sense to me.
See, A View to a Kill should have been which Tim Dalton was the one with the assassin, the second one.
That was License to Kill.
See, that's A View to a Kill. As a sniper. A sniper has a view to a kill.
Exactly. Or A View to a Kill would be a good one if Bond was kidnapped and thrown in an underground fighting ring where he had to fight his way to survival, and everyone looked on from above. That would be A View to a Kill.
That's a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie right there. That's not a Bond movie.
No. Q is the one who gets A View to a Kill because he's watching Bond, so it's A View to a Killer.
That's just a view.
Yeah, that's not necessarily a kill unless...
It's a room with a view.
Yeah, well, I don't know. What's the survival rate of Bond girls?
Ooh.
And there you go. Bond is
not good.
Bond is Jeffrey Dahmer at this point, with less of an appetite.
Oh,
took a turn, yeah.
So we can go to Fire Truck San Francisco.
Yes, you're right. I'm seeing he has sex with people and then they die.
Oh no, I was asking if you were saying that Bond ate Bond girls.
We don't know. He doesn't.
Well, in Jeff Dahmer's case, I think the opposite was true.
That's true. So Bond ends up in San Francisco because of question mark.
That's where the Riddler is.
Well, that's where Zorin is because Silicon Valley's nearby, and that's what he wants to destroy.
We have the CIA agent Lee, right? Who, because
he's Asian.
Yes, right. And in San Francisco, and he's a fishmonger. And the keyword is asking for soft shell crab, which apparently no one ever else does.
No one's done this.
Did he claim he could cut a bottle in half with a cleaver?
I do like the idea, though, that if anyone else asks for softshell crab, he takes them to the back, and if they're not James Bond, he murders them.
Was that the Kurt Vonnegut?
Softshell crab.
Was that the Kurt Vonnegut guy who insisted that all the crabs are dying?
No, they're gone. That's the guy that he takes them to. Yeah, okay. Kurt Vonnegut.
That dude looked exactly like Kurt Vonnegut.
Kurt Vonnegut is a CIA secret.
Well, I mean, it doesn't surprise me. But are we ever explained why the crabs are dying?
No.
And we're never explained why softshell crabs is the password.
No.
Which is a very obvious one, because usually there's a back and forth, but there's not a back and forth. I would like softshell crabs. Thank you, Englishman.
Come on back.
Do you remember that Simpsons bit where people go into the photo mat and the password is cheese?
Hello, Agent Johnson. Yes.
To be fair, it's kind of like in Doctor Who in like the late aughts when they had to tie in this whole thing to the bees disappearing. There was a huge crab disappearance in the 80s, and so they probably were tying into something that was sort of kind of in the papers and sort of kind of not on everybody's mind.
Well, of course, when I go...
No, there really was. This is what I get from watching Deadliest Catch.
Oh. Well, of course, when I watch a Bond film, I expect to be informed about socio-political matters, especially as they relate to environmentalist causes. So well done, A View to a Kill.
Well, we all know that crabs were disappearing because of that shampoo.
You win, Nick. You win. Yeah, you just won.
I give up. I can't beat that.
I do have an honest question,
and
though.
And we're over. Yeah.
Why did they end up in San Fran, though? Like, other than to make part of it a Dirty Harry movie where they're jumping over the hills of San Francisco.
That was meant to be a Dirty Harry montage. Suddenly, this movie sucks a lot more.
Because San Francisco equals microchip, and everybody, everybody knows that.
Well, I mean,
true.
But it's also so
Golden
lazy.
Golden Gate Bridge paid for this.
Well, again, Zorin's there. We'll get to him in a second, I hope, because this movie's too long. We've talked about it even longer, but like at one point there's a KGB agent with a Corvette. We should have had a bullet scene, like literally of them driving along the curves of the mountain, because why else? Like, you film in San Francisco so you get the jumps over the hills and like going down Lombard Street. Like, it's a beautiful city to film in for a reason, and we get literally none of it.
We get the bridge, and we also get like Chinatown with a Japanese mall.
And even worse than that, we get the bridge, but whenever there's a stunt going on, they don't color the scene right. So the bridge turns gray whenever we see Roger Moore's face.
In green screen, because he's in Pinewood.
And the color changes the background, because again, he leaves England only for food, possibly. Because I believe he was in Hong Kong to eat. Like really? Like,
you believe that? Really?
In what was his second movie, maybe.
Well, to eat what?
Which we didn't get in this movie. We didn't get that.
You're right. We didn't get it even once.
I don't think we got that cue.
Either one. Yeah, I don't think we did.
I mean, I would buy we got it once when Bond was like getting his rental car, like in Doctor Now, where he's just walking through a hotel.
And yeah, that was rough. They were still learning there. But even here, like, even we as a group were watching it and we would think, this is a scene that called for da-da-da-da.
Anything.
And it didn't.
And it was just silence.
It was either silent or it was like the theme of the movie, which was just lame.
To the point where we looked around and went, has anyone heard music? Do you remember? Was there music in this movie?
It was very forgettable.
Well, it makes you realize that for Live and Let Die, George Martin is also credited as the music producer. And it works because the theme is throughout the whole time. There's music filling every scene, and not only does it fade into the kind of the Norman Bond theme, but then it goes back to Live and Let Die. And so that's the hit constantly. Here, it's a lot of awkward silence because when Bond makes a joke and it doesn't land, which frankly is often, all we get is the fire burning in the background of the when they burn down the building, which I think is actually the city capital
What's the phrase? Bildungsroman? Where you've got a theme going throughout the entire thing?
Yeah, exactly right. Bildungsroman. Yeah. And that's what we're missing. We're missing any semblance of of something that matters. Because, frankly,
everything in this movie does not.
Nothing. It's not even like Goldfinger where Bond stumbles into the plot. There's no plot. There's nothing.
Yeah.
And Daniel alluded to it, so we can cut to this, but, at one point, there's a scene that we're introduced to where, every Spectre scene, there's a round table of angry business people, but at this point, they're not even corrupt business people.
No.
Because people aren't even interested in being part of this plot. Right? But a bunch of industrialists who make microchips are I guess, dealing with Zorn. And Zorn's
presumably,
like,
they don't have holdings in Silicon Valley.
So they're all European or Asian.
Well, the one dude is Asian.
Yeah. Quite literally. And he looks like completely baffled. He really is this kind of probably San Francisco actor because he has no hint of an accent. They don't try to make him have an accent, which I'm grateful for, because a lot of the Asian stereotypes in these movies is atrocious. But he says, I'm not going to be a part of this, because essentially he is saying, you pay me $100 million and give me half your profits because I'm going to destroy Silicon Valley if I flood it, so all the chips are destroyed, and you get your chips only from me or whatever, et cetera, fine. Grace Jones escorts the man who says, no, I'm not going to play ball, and she throws him out, and he turns into the worst dummy that has ever been made.
Because they're in a blimp.
Yes.
They're in a blimp, and he gets thrown out, which is the cold... It's the reveal, but if you've seen this movie before, or seen the posters, which show blimps in it...
What I love is how they cut to the dummy, and it looks like crap. They cut away from it, they cut back to it, and the legs are just going all over the place. It's like, they really felt proud of this dummy. They needed us to see it.
Mm-hmm. Comedic skits that were based on the obviousness of the dummy being a dummy... were more convincing than this scene.
I mean, and we haven't even got to my favorite scene, which is later on after Who's a Fuzz. What's Tanya Roberts' character's name? The geologist.
Does anybody know?
Stacy Sutton.
Screaming Girl.
Stacy. Okay, Stacy Sutton.
That's why we don't remember
it. Sutton.
Is it a... In any way a pun at all?
Nope.
That's
nope.
where they let
nope.
us down. That's the failure.
Because she's supposed to be knowledgeable. She's the daughter of the Sutton Oil Group.
Oh, that whole thing.
That's Sutton, which is why Chinese CIA guy couldn't track her down.
Right.
And
she gets paid off because...
She's
what's
a geologist, and Zorn is trying to pay her off
to settle because...
Is the premise that he used a legalese... Basically, we talk about techno-babble crap. This was legal battle crap.
Yeah.
Where he managed to do something to basically steal Sutton Oil away from her and her father.
It turns into Wall Street for a scene where we get some Gordon Gekko bullshit.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, actually, this would be a good, almost a game. What would be a better name for her? I'm thinking of Oil Derek.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you keep winning these games, Nick?
I mean, I got nothing, but,
Frackle Rock.
Oh.
I stand corrected.
Drill Bits.
Pippin Line.
Yeah, there we go. There you go. Yeah, exactly.
Anything other than Stacy Sutton, which is so 80s.
Yeah, no,
Stacy.
Well, I mean, it might as well be Pamela. Regardless.
You know, all this stuff about geology, and there's not the most obvious Bond pun. I'd like to help you drill for oil.
Petrochemicals. No, sorry.
No, petro. There you go.
But, I mean, the other side of this is Zorin's house is literally Versailles. Hyperbole free,
It's a very, very, very fine house.
And then the life used to be hard, man. They go to his office, and it's, filled with, antique globes and everything everywhere. Fine. They show her house. There's no furniture in any room except for the bed.
She did explain that, though.
Well, they blew up.
They did.
Yeah.
They blew up. They blew all their money on the cat.
Who might be the third best actor in this. Right? It showed up and it meowed at the right points, man.
Yeah. Scared the hell out of me.
Yeah, that was
great,
the one
great blocking.
Scare.
They realized the movie was lulling everyone to sleep and they said, screw it, we need to wake everyone the hell back up.
There was a damn PA who threw a cat down a flight of stairs.
I mean, when we go from boring movie to Bond entering an empty house, mm-hmm. like literally empty house, he's walking up the stairs and a cat jumps out all of a sudden.
And we make fun of
that. We all jumped at it and we're like, what the fuck?
I mean, it was such a mood shift that when he was creeping up the stairs, you know, opening the door to the bathroom where there's a shower running, and in any other Bond movie you'd be like, okay, there's obviously a hot woman in the shower. I was expecting a pair of twins.
Yeah. That's exactly it. And
that's
like
what you were expecting?
Yes.
Twins, Basil, twins.
Well, and I mean, this movie is a comedic fart compared to the movies that reference it later. But this literally must be the forerunner of what? Well, first, Christmas Story. Because his fantasy where he's Black Bart is this, where he has the one gun in a house of people sneaking in the shadows outside of window shades. But I was thinking of LA Confidential and Skyfall, right? Because that's what this is. This is Bond in Skyfall, but like he has a shotgun filled with saltpeter that he never has to reload that we don't even think about, but he just keeps shooting a shotgun.
Saltpeter is so much worse because that's not what it is.
Oh, no, it's rock salt.
But saltpeter being something given to Bond would be hilarious.
Well, I could just imagine Bond shooting all of the other, you know, male, you know, actors in the movie with something that means they can't get it up for a day.
I mean, on the other hand,
Bond shooting blanks.
Oh, no. Although that would explain a lot.
57-year-old Bond. Wait, let me try this.
I mean, it is a great scene where Bond shoots a guy with, like, point blank with a rifle. And the guy falls back, looks up in, like, astonishment, and he's, like, patting himself. What the fuck just happened? Yeah. And Bond says, what are you doing? What did you load this with? And the girl says, rock salt. And everyone just kind of looks at each other and... Then the fight continues.
Yeah, was it a rock?
It is basically the one nod to the fact that, yes, this really was a haunted house.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I mean, and again, you flip it around. We had pitched this when we were watching this. It would be better if this was like the Amityville Horror House. Like, if Bond was like, my God. Like, and the walls were fighting the villains. Like, they got sucked into, like, black portal. Like, you know, like, they open a door, it's like a black hole, and they get sucked through it. Like, that'd be awesome.
That would be
awesome. That's right up there with the crew of Firefly boarding the ship from Event Horizon.
Yeah, that's exactly
there you go.
Right? Like, and if like, someone comes back and there are no eyes, like, that's great.
How come that movie doesn't exist? While A View to a Kill is allowed to exist.
Yeah. Because this is the point where the Broccoli's weren't ambitious. Right?
Because of the next scene. Well, which is Blues Brothers meets San Francisco James Bond.
Oh, yeah.
Well, no, the next scene is literally Bond trying to protect a woman, but being an old man and falling asleep on the job, because he has a shotgun across his lap and is in such a deep sleep that she surprises him with breakfast.
Oh, yeah. Breakfast out of bed, I believe the line is.
Because he's asleep, like, and he's supposed to be protecting her, and he's like, my God, he dusted himself off and played off like he intended it for it to happen.
Dust himself.
After he makes her a quiche and says that it's a...
quiche de cabinet, which means it's an omelet.
Yeah.
Or whatever he found in the cabinets.
Pie crust, yeah.
Yeah.
I like the idea that Bond didn't cook with roofies.
One time.
Jesus.
Yeah.
They did each drink a bottle of wine, if you notice. Regardless, that's when the rest of the movie happens, which is not a movie.
You mean the who cares part of the plot?
Yeah.
I thought that happened a while back.
That's when they get caught in the Capitol and it gets burned down. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go ahead and spoil something from here. I'm sitting next to John. He was taking notes throughout this, and his last page is like not even a quarter full of notes.
No, I just gave up.
Yeah, he just gave up.
I almost
want to auction off your notepad lines. When we're done.
Oh, yeah.
And then all right. Mayday good.
Instead,
and then they're all dead.
In fact,
that's actually a good summary.
Instead of going through what the plot for the rest of the movie is, why don't we go through what all of the scenes that were set in scenes we'd seen in other movies was?
Well, there was
all of them?
Oh.
I know. It's. It's a tall order,
horse
isn't it?
Horse racing, Versailles.
There was the minecart scene.
Two movies ago.
There was a minecart scene from Temple of Doom. Yeah. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
And again, if it's Pinewood, it might literally be the set. And someone had to make it. And John Glenn made the call to Spielberg. I may have ruined everything. I literally may have ruined everything. And I mean, with a yellow color filter, it also might be the second to third last scene in the first movie, in the first Indiana Jones movie, when they're in the sand pit digging, right? Like inside the pyramid of Giza. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But we certainly had a tiny city model.
Yeah.
We did. We got a model.
Yeah.
And we were actually commenting during the movie that, man, wouldn't it be great to be that guy who made all the models?
And who was it? Who was it who said that the Eiffel Tower scene looked like the scene out of GoldenEye?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With the running up the steps at the end of the satellite in GoldenEye.
Well,
yeah.
The scene with the model reminded me of that scene from Donald Trump's The Art of the Deal. I just kept wondering, why didn't Max Zorn build the mini people?
So there I was. My one life goal is to get the Taj Mahal.
There you go.
It's going to be huge.
Bruce Wayne.
Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne. Very, very great guy. Very, very great guy. I've had a lot of meals with him. Very great guy. Why is he dressed up like Batman? Why?
He should be more spectacular like that Spider-Man kid.
I just want to say, I've very got sad. Bigger hands than that Grace Jones woman. Much bigger hands.
But once you go black, you just don't go back.
No.
It actually makes a lot more sense with Donald Trump. As Max Zorin. It makes so much more sense.
I'm going to build...
Johnny Depp would be a good Bond
villain. Is that including or not including him being the product of Nazi experiments?
Oh, there you go.
Yes.
Only his wig is a product of Nazi experiments.
True.
I thought that was a highly evolved caterpillar.
I'm going to build a great blimp. It's going to be the greatest blimp anyone has ever seen.
There is a conspiracy podcast somewhere that says, like, in the last page of Mengele's journal, as the Thule Society predicted, is a wig of great yellow power. Some sort of black magic ritual by Aleister Crowley to make a wig to make precedent. Like, I just imagine it like that Simpsons Halloween sketch where they pull it off and someone else gets the power. Like, it just crawls along.
Oh, when they executed Snake and whoever, yeah.
Like, you just...
Oh, God. By the power of Trump's skull, I have the power!
And that, ladies and gentlemen, we are officially off the rails.
Oh, my God. Another blimp.
So we're done, right?
Are we there yet?
This crazy train is not stopping.
No. Well, first there's the mines, and Grace Jones dies.
Grace Jones dies in an explosion that takes out maybe two railroad ties, and this was an explosion powerful enough to set off the San Andreas Vault. Oh, except they don't think they bought the rights to the name San Andreas Vault. They were called it a different name.
They did.
But it's in San Francisco, so
that's just the breaks.
To be fair, the bomb that she blew up in was not in a room full of dynamite. Like, bags of dynamite.
Yeah, no, so the idea is, if we haven't made it clear, because this movie makes no sense and neither does the plot, Max Zorn is going to set up, like, a room full of thermite and dynamite, or whatever it is. It's a bag that just says Zorn on it, so whatever. Maybe it's just skin samples.
Nazi skin samples.
It's not the skin samples you're looking for. And then there's inside this timed explosive device that looks like... God. It reminded me of the scene from Aliens where she lowers into the room filled with eggs, right?
Oh, yeah.
Jurassic Park in the book. Whatever. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. There's a room filled with dynamite, and there's one explosive device in the middle. It's supposed to set off all the other bags of explosives. So Grace Jones, being the Incredible Hulk, lifts both Bond and the bomb out and then sacrifices herself because the brakes are broken, so they can't just shove the bomb away. She has to literally hold the brake.
It's on a mine car.
Or use some shoelaces and tie it off. Or, you know, just leave it there because, as previously stated, that bomb was only powerful enough to take out two railroad ties. It was already far enough.
And literally when it blows up, when we see it, the miniature is barely a poof.
Yeah.
Like, it's nothing.
It was like a weak stick of dynamite, honestly.
It was, and it looked like if you dropped a grenade in the same pit, it would have done just as much damage. So why more. Bother?
Yeah.
Like, literally, why bother?
If it had been a nuke, maybe.
It
that would have made more sense.
It looked like a nuclear
it
warhead.
It looked like a trick... typical well, Bond.
They had to save that scene for The World Is Not Enough, though, yeah. where it actually mattered and there were emotional stakes involved.
And I realize this is shooting fish in a barrel, talking about the things that Bond villains could have done, but if Max Schreck hadn't gone for his blimp, but instead had just returned back around and thrown a grenade down that pit, he would have succeeded in everything that he wanted to, because that's all it would have taken.
And he had a bunch of TNT sticks in his blimp! We saw them because the mad scientist tried to throw one at Bond.
Man, this is really a Zorn in your thigh.
Let's face it, though. This is his MO. He goes through this entire film putting Bond into quote-unquote unescapable situations, which Bond obviously miraculously escapes from. So this is very much his motto. I could end it now, but the stakes are so much higher if we leave things to chance, right?
No. Steve's absolutely right. There was a meet cute, and this is a rom-com. He just says he's leading him on.
Yeah, that's right. Ooh, so you escaped, Bond.
So you're only one who could beat my last lover, Mayday.
So my question here is, I mean, obviously not the villain image, but is there a villain that more influenced the style of Dr. Evil than Max Zorin?
Well, yeah, Lorne Michaels himself.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you might be absolutely right. Like, because this is a like, because the thing is, this is a movie. This is why on Myopia we don't do comedies. Nothing is harder than a comedy to make fun of, because it's trying to make jokes and failing.
Mm-hmm.
This movie,
much like
wants
this movie,
to, yeah, that's what it is. This movie is trying to be funny, and Roger Moore has no lines to deliver.
Nor does he care.
No, he clearly
he's
does not
up.
Care.
What was the worst pun in the movie? There, it turns out the entire horse stable is an elevator, and he says something like, you
"What
know,
a letdown!" Or something.
No. And then the next, what was it when he goes up? You know, how did you sleep? Oh, it was terribly, but I finally got off, or something like that. And you're like,
my personal pick would be that scene with the conveyor belt after they dispatched those two henchmen in the boxes, and the one guy was knocked out but wakes up. It's like, I wish I could have helped you. We got it all wrapped up.
That was a horrible fight scene. I love the henchmen getting tied up and sent down the conveyor belt, but just punches were thrown and no reaction whatsoever to the punch. It was not.
There
a
was
good
a
scene.
Sound effect in there, so you knew it connected.
That was
but that,
a,
was,
that
it.
Was a roughly choreographed scene.
Yeah.
Well, and the other side of it is, what do you want out of Bond? And here the problem is everything. He does literally nothing in here. Like he's not. He's not somehow... I mean, I don't want a superhero, but I want someone who can be incredible in a way I'm not. He does nothing. He drives a truck for a bit.
Yeah.
He's not all that he
Fire
can
truck.
Be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
But how many of the situations that he's in that are dangerous is he in for any reason other than he got himself into them?
Yeah.
Like, not even the villain. Like, well, he's hanging from the ladder of the truck.
That's the Roger Moore curse, isn't it? That most of the times that he's in, like, actual, honest-to-God danger, he put himself there.
Yeah.
And he has to get himself out, or someone else has to get himself out, or the plot has to get him out. Yeah.
So what you're saying is that this would be a considerably better movie if you replaced what little soundtrack there was with the soundtrack to an episode of Mr. Bean.
Yes. He was a very
considering he was in the last movie, you're not far off.
That would have made this so much better.
Well, I mean, but again,
even the James Bond soundtrack would have been better.
You mean anything?
Here's my question.
Nice.
Do we think that they, you know, based on what they spent this movie, they gave too much money to Duran Duran and whatever they worked on effects and go, oh crap, we don't have a soundtrack. Well,
no,
shit.
It must have been a choice, because if you buy the sound, you should have had the whole thing. Because, like, again, think of Back to the Future. Like, Huey Lewis has a couple songs, but most of it is literally the dun-dun-dun, which is the same year.
Yeah.
Like, the idea is, like, you can't even say it's a 1980s stylistic choice, because other movies from this same year have music throughout.
Well, no, hell, Back to the Future had a few Huey Lewis songs, that Alan Silvestri song, and it had a Clapton song to throw in there to boot, so I think the
Not
money was available.
Johnny B. Good. I know, I got it from Columbia Record for a nickel.
Was that the free tape?
That was one of the... The free one was the Animal House soundtrack.
Oh, much better
then
choice.
Then the Blues Brothers. This one I paid a nickel for the first 10.
Oh.
I learned it. Don't worry. I was a minor, so they couldn't find me for the rest.
Oh, there you go.
My name is John Copsey.
I don't think that's right.
I always had a fantasy in the back of my head that if I was ever pulled over. Yes. No. I would just list my elementary school bully's name. I'd be like, my name is, I don't know, Steve Carlsberg or whatever. And then someone would be like, my God. You're one in 6 days. You'll never catch me. Run.
Steve
anyway,
Carlsberg.
You know,
Steve Carlsberg.
I'll need to. I didn't say my brother-in-law's name. Steve.
Charles.
Yeah,
Smythe.
No, St. John Smythe.
St. John Smythe. Yes.
This is what it needed was Groucho Marx going, Smythe, yes, right, yes.
I do like the idea that the section chief was his butler or whatever, his manservant.
The thing is, it's very hard for me to complain about a spy actually coming up with a cover name, but I really do miss the other Bond movies where James Bond was considered enough of a cover name, even though everyone should know it by now.
Or just not giving enough of a crap to care.
Yes.
Well, but again, it's literally like, I made the joke when we were watching it, like there's something called Spy Magazine and Bond's always on the cover. Like, he never has a disguise, but his name is always like, wait, are you the James Bond? Because, like, even when he tells what's-her-face, Stacy, that his name is actually Bond James Bond from British Intelligence, like, she's like, James Bond? Really? And he's like, what is going on in San Francisco in 85?
I thought you looked more like that Sean Connery guy.
I thought you had a Scottish accent and then you were better at this. Although, to be fair, the next time I remember Sean Connery is when he's on The Rock.
Yeah. I thought you were younger.
Right. Which was a better Bond film.
You'd be wrong. You know what? You're right. I would love it if Daniel Craig ends up in prison and the next movie is him literally breaking out.
Yeah.
Like it's the Arkham Asylum version of
anything.
That would be cool, actually.
No, that would be great. Like if Bond finds, like, the next movie starts out with him as criminal of the state and him and, like, who's the guy who's playing Spectre?
The guy from Inglourious Basterds.
We all know this.
Jeez. All those commercials he's in now.
The guy with the name in the face.
Christoph Waltz.
Yeah. Like him and Waltz are like cellmates and they break out of prison together and that's the start of the next Bond movie.
I still think Bond needs to face an illegitimate son. That needs to be a Bond.
Like no. A cadre of illegitimate sons.
Spectre is nothing but
Bond. Yeah, exactly.
And the son starts out as Robin, but then becomes Red Hood.
Because you've got to do something different, because otherwise you're just ripping off the plot to Star Trek Nemesis.
Well, exactly.
Yes. Which, if you're going to rip off a movie, make it a better movie.
Yes, seriously.
It should be Star Wars, Star Trek Generations, and then there's Pierce Brosnan shows up. It's like, please hire me for anything.
It's a sweet spot you got to hit. You don't want to rip off terrible movies, but if you rip off Wrath of Khan, people are going to get angry at you.
Yeah.
I want to die on the bridge. Fine, I'll die on a bridge. You'll die on a bridge.
Oh my god! Dance into the fire.
Which brings us to how Zorin dies. He gets tossed off the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yes.
Sure does.
Yeah. And he dies as a terrible, terrible dummy falling into the water.
Oh my God, the arms ripple as they fall to the ground.
In other words, the most evil death that he inflicts on someone else is in fact the death he dies himself. See, it's symmetry, right? You all can see the symmetry, right?
Oh yeah.
This is a problem just as far as Bond movies go. It's not uncommon for the main villain to die first, but usually the last person he fights is the henchman. And so Zorin should die and then Mayday should be the one he fights to the death. Instead, we get this geriatric Nazi who can't even pick up
a stick of dynamite.
Yeah.
Who fires 6 shots out of a revolver, misses every time, and then is literally holding dynamite before we cut to the scene of MST3K's intro sequence.
Fumbling the dynamite!
It's him and the doctor from The Pretender.
Yes.
Fumbling the stick of dynamite.
Might as well have literally been fighting over it, like a tug of war, and then
I want to throw it out the blimp.
Yeah.
No me.
give it up, old man, you can't throw, and then they explode.
Yeah. And what movie, might and then, be the most realistic blimp explosion to film?
Yeah. I mean,
not Zeppelin.
For the first time, and the first time I can think of in a movie, the Zeppelin itself did not explode. It wasn't filled with hydrogen, yeah, helium. So only the actual manned cabin, area, yeah, the cabin, yeah, exploded.
Are we praising this movie for its realism at this point?
Every movie, no matter how bad, has something it has to be praised for. Even if it's, you know, like a runner-up prize.
Yeah.
Daniel, it's called a compliment sandwich. We start with a compliment, we shit on the movie for an hour, and then we end with a compliment.
Okay, I see.
I liked his Conan O'Brien haircut, too.
Oh, yeah.
I will say, at the end of the day, the problem with this movie, as far as special effects goes, there's plot problems throughout, is they use special effects in chunks, and some scenes were really good that used almost all the money, and the rest was garbage. Like, because some of the blimp sequences and like were pretty good, and then for 85, 30 years old, but then in between, there's a lot of like dummies that flail.
For every good blimp scene, there's a dummy that fails, or there's a blimp that you can clearly see the wires, or there's a more in front of a very obvious blue screen.
A dummy that fails. I think that would have been a perfectly accurate plot description.
Yeah, the long-forgotten Ian Fleming short story, The Dummy That Fails.
Was this a time where, like, blimps and zeppelins were trying to make a comeback?
Well, no, it's if you've got Nazis, you have to have zeppelins. This is one of those Hollywood rules.
I missed that part.
Well, again, okay, this might be something that was permanently ruined by Indiana Jones. Right? I know it's Last Crusade that has a scene on a Zeppelin, but like...
No, no ticket.
It was part of the Treaty Accords at the end of World War II. If you're going to represent us in movies, there must be Zeppelins.
Right. There are two things. If you see a Zeppelin movie, it means one of two things, okay? It means either there are Nazis nearby or you're in an alternate reality.
How much better would it have been if Bond didn't... How much better would it have been if Bond hadn't...
This film?
No, that was Michelin.
Michelin, sorry.
Yeah, Michelin. You're right. I was going to say, how much better would it have been if Bond had missed the blimp and had to catch the, like, the MetLife blimp? So Snoopy is, like, catching up rapidly.
Hang on.
No, sorry, that's the wrong... Well, Snoopy,
we're not in Ohio. Snoopy is always sung in Ohio.
We briefly joked about when the balloon was inflating that it would be one of the Macy's Day Parade kind of...
Underdog shows up.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I really, like, at this point, the movie is completely disintegrated. Yeah.
There's no need to fear. Max Zorin is here.
Was his first name really Max, too?
It was. People have been saying it.
Zorin.
Yeah. I mean, he just changes his last name. This is like, you know, Mengele ending up in Argentina or whatever. Like, this, again, we're right on the verge of, like, you see a blimp show up in, like, Brazil and you're just like, I am not Zadolf. And as I recall, the Nazi quote-unquote cloning technique was literally just injecting pregnant women with steroids?
Something yeah, basically. Like that, yeah.
So
yeah.
It wasn't even like... They didn't even be as ambitious as, like, they were early genetic engineers. No, they're just injecting people with...
Roids.
Which doesn't make them strong, it makes them smart.
Which is not
how roids
it's
work.
It's not like Archer, where they were flat-out clones of Hitler. They were just steroid babies.
But that's the problem with the late 80s movies.
Kind of like heroin.
Or Superman at World's End, where it was twin clones of Hitler.
Something that's even worse than this movie. Let's not mention that.
All right, gentlemen, around the board, we're done with this movie because I'm stopping it.
Thank you, God.
This is, unfortunately, though, the last Roger Moore movie.
That's
hooray!
Unfortunate.
Hooray!
No, it's unfortunate because this is his last movie. Because I kind of like some of the other ones. I mean, that's why I'm saying it's unfortunate.
Oh, okay.
Not that this should be any actor's last movie. Like, literally.
I still think Sean Connery had a worse last movie.
No, Diamonds Are Forever is good.
Okay, Last Bond movie.
Roger Moore had Spice World to look forward to.
Yeah.
So there you go.
On the other hand, Sean Connery had League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Ooh.
What's the one where he's a monk investigating a witch?
Roger Moore?
No, Sean Connery.
Ooh.
Ooh. It's probably still better than the one where he's playing the Asian guy.
So it's not The Wicker Man.
Zardoz?
That would be Nick Cage.
No, it's not Zardoz.
You obviously
Nick Cage should be Bond.
Oh.
No.
No.
He should be Superman.
Well, to be fair. Okay, the question for you all. If you had to choose Christopher Walken or Nick Cage to inject into a Bond movie, which one would you choose?
Walken. Nick Cage.
Walken.
Walken.
All right, there we go.
I'm walking away with this
one.
We're walking.
I'm sort of tied.
No. Sudis, I'm going to put you on the spot. In which role?
As the villain.
As the villain, Nick Cage?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I would love a movie, we talked about this before, where Bond wanders into a plot where two villains are fighting against each other. So Walken versus Cage to take over the world, and Bond just has to be the last moment stand-in. You know, like the one who like stops the plot from taking over, but they're fighting each other to destroy the planet.
So he's like the incidental hero again. He just happens
to be there.
Well,
I mean, it's like Indiana Jones in the Raiders of the Lost Ark, where he just like literally the Nazis would have melted just faster without him.
Yeah. Like many of the other Bond movies that we've watched, it's the Soviets versus X third party, and Bond just happens to wander into it. Just let the third party and the Soviets fight each other out.
Speaking of, Gogol is the best part.
Yeah.
Like, where he just shows up, he's like, I'm literally going to give Bond the Medal of Lenin because you saved the day for us, too.
Yeah, because we're totally pirating everything that comes out of Silicon Valley.
And guess what? He really had gone off the rails. You helped us out. I would have liked a Star Wars awarding sequence where it had like the crest of Victoria as well, and then like an Iron Cross because of awkwardness. And then like a medallion
and
of Lenin.
I think Gogol actually said like something to the effect of, "If it wasn't for Silicon Valley, Russia wouldn't be where it was right now." Because we copy everything off of you.
Would Chewie finally get a medal in this sequence?
No.
Would that be Miss Moneypenny?
Well, he's big enough they could hang Miss Moneypenny around his neck.
Oh, there
Thank
you go.
God you said her, not me. Maybe it gets the valiant death.
She does?
Yeah, she dies a hero.
She's the Porkins of this episode.
The game from
might be the worst name Lucas ever came up with. Okay, so give me your thoughts on Roger. Because he's done. This is it. This is his last movie, and we'll do a wrap-up of all the Bonds when we're done. But at this point, this is our last Bond.
With Roger, it was like Adam West being Batman. You knew, especially in hindsight, you knew there was better things ahead. So I guess some people who grew up with it have great nostalgia for it. But at this point in time, I mean, there's a lot more wrong than right here. I mean, The Spy Who Loved Me was good. I like that one. For Your Eyes Only was fine. But other than that, I mean, I can't think of like one Roger Moore that I'd ever want to revisit.
John, anyone?
I'm kind of the same. That, I mean, he opened up with blaxploitation, and he ended with just blur. And Roger Moore, to his credit, was very pop culture. A lot of his movies dealt with what was going on at the time. I forget what the movie was where they had like the oil crisis and they kept hitting us over the head with the oil crisis. It was Man with the Golden Gun.
That brought
in the MacGuffin. But regardless, it was very, this is what's going on now, so we'll make a movie that's relevant now. Which we're still kind of seeing bits of that. But Roger Moore as a Bond, just, he sucked. I hated him.
I'll put this, and this is, I mean, it's setting the bar low for me. I liked him more than George Lazenby.
All right.
Like, but, I mean, I don't hate him. There's some parts I enjoy. His quips are kind of enjoyable, and some of the gadgets are fun. I think he's a much more campy Bond than I prefer. There's some fun to it, and I'll watch it if it's on. I'm not necessarily going to reach into my DVD collection and pull it out, but I this was an awful movie. I'm not defending this one at all. I can't.
It seems to be the pattern for a lot of Bonds that they start out fairly strong and they degrade over time, which adds to why they keep changing him. But no, Roger Moore just strikes me very much as a tourist in everything. Most of his troubles are his own fault as he gets in without understanding the situation that he's in. And, and he's a very funny, very capable guy if you happen to be sitting in the right context to understand him. But if you don't, it's like, well, why did you just enter that tube with that spinning fan or fan that's not spinning, but there's nothing beyond it anyway, so it's a death trap if anyone turns it on.
So for me, this was a very merciful end to a chapter which was not, you know, it did not ingrain itself in my memory for good reason. I like the point about him being a tourist almost. It does almost, for me, Roger Moore always felt like a very sort of incidental hero. Not just in this movie, but all of them. Not especially clever, not very well scripted, which is not really his fault. The gadgets, just nothing about it really gripped me and felt like, yeah, this is a real spy drama where there are elements of cleverness and suspense. And I'm rambling, of course, but this is exactly how it felt to me. Just like a string of shit that made no sense in a lot of contexts. And you take him out and put him in a lot of the other films, and he's just not, he's gonna tread water at best. So, I don't want to say good riddance because it feels very rude, but looking forward to greener pastures for sure.
Thomas, do you have any thoughts? Or
I spoke.
Well, I mean, like, well, it's not even that
forgettable, Tom.
Much like this movie.
Well, I mean, it's just like a wet fart.
not forgettable.
Smells the worst.
Here's the thing for me. Like, I know our next movie is Tim Dalton, right? A View to a Kill is next, right? Yeah, The Living Daylights is
We are never escaping this movie. It's going to be like Groundhog's Day all over again.
Oh, Jesus.
Here's the thing. Purgatory. I like that Roger Moore can deliver a joke without the smirk. Because, like, Sean Connery, like, even in, like, Diamonds Are Forever, which is a very funny movie, is a lot of him just, like, killing someone and going, huh. I imagine James Bond is someone with severe PTSD, and so by the time we get to the Pierce Brosnan era, he's literally making quips to no one. Like, he's literally looking around him and going, like, well, that was a funny way to die. Ha-ha! And there's just an echo because his loneliness is the only voice in his head. You know, Roger Moore is someone who literally, again, if we're talking about the most English person comparing how, like, tea should be served, and, like, the only stunt we believed he could actually do is riding a horse, because in some preppy English school, he's serving himself tea while teaching himself how to tie a cravat versus a tie.
There's a difference.
There is! I mean, you know, Freddy from Scooby-Doo Gang could tell you. However, I want to make the point that Roger is someone who should be able to dictate a joke. This is his last movie. There's 1,000 theories as to why. The one I heard the most, of course, is that when he was meeting people on the set, he met the Bond girl's mom and he was older than the Bond girl's mom, Tanya Roberts, which is awkward enough. But the thing is, he clearly can't do any of the stunts. When he's throwing the punches, the stunt guy has to do more than he does. He's not only 3 years too old to be Bond, he's 20 years too old to even act the part, which at 56, I get.
At 56, he was older than William Harnell was when he first played this very old man on Doctor Who. He started at 55.
And the game is not that he's playing it old. He's still playing it as Bond. Mm-hmm. If he literally was playing retiring Bond like that Sherlock Holmes movie where Ian McKellen was playing the retired Sherlock Holmes, that would make sense. But here he's just supposed to be as young, as agile as
ever. Even Never Say Never Again, it worked because Sean Connery was older, but they at least acknowledged it.
Yeah, you're too old, you're too fat, go on a diet.
But this never happened to the other guy.
Yes. I like this. I like Roger Moore because he can deliver a joke. The problem is they didn't even give him jokes to deliver. They just sent the old man out to be an old man. That's a shame. If he ended on...
Even the puns in this movie were just... They all fell short.
There were
every
jokes.
Single one. We knew when they were said, and we all just said, that's not funny.
And we came up with better ones watching it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think... What was it? The Broccolis talked about the fact that he even said after this movie, he said, I shouldn't have brought Roger Moore back for this. And it's almost like he decided that after he brought him back and was just like, well, screw it. We're stuck here now. Let's just make it through and get to the next movie.
It's too late.
Yeah, and it just hurt for it.
Well, and it's almost a problem here with Daniel Craig. I love Daniel Craig, but he was the one who had to say, I need to go.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, I know it sounds like some pet movie in a kid's movie, right? Like, where they're just like, it was time to let him go. But at the same time, Roger at this point is literally wearing, like, reading glasses. Like,
I have to go back to my home planet now.
Which is literally one of the props where he takes giant glasses and adjusts them. I think Moneypenny had an elegant end here, mm-hmm. where yes, Bond actually gives her, like, here, you win. She's the only one who wins in the movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's certainly not the audience.
No.
Certainly
not the
audience.
No.
I guess Duran Duran wins, but they said we went into the fire.
Like, we went on purpose after seeing this. Not
yeah. But unfortunately, guys, we're done. We're done with Roger Moore. We're done. We have one more John Glenn movie, as John pointed out. He comes back to direct The Living Daylights,
all right.
Which is our next film. However, that means Mission Briefing is done. So tune in next time when Bond returns with The Living Daylights. Thanks, guys.
Mission Briefing and Myopia Defend Your Childhood are produced by Dude Letter Podcasting. It's hosted and edited by Nick Hoffman. Our graphic designer is Scott Miller. The theme song is sampled from Monty Norman's James Bond theme. Questions and comments? Please visit myopiapodcast.com/missionbriefing or contact us through myopiamissionbriefing@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @missionbriefing and @myopiapodcast. And find us on Facebook, Stitcher, and iTunes. And while you're on iTunes, please rate and review our podcast. Want to help us out? Go to myopiapodcast.com/Amazon and purchase stuff like normal. Myopia and Mission Briefing get a piece of the action.
You've been listening to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast that explores the many worlds of all things geek. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. And if we find what you say interesting, we'll put it up on the air. If you've enjoyed our show, please rate us or leave feedback for us up on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our show or any of the ESO Network podcasts. We can also be found up on Stitcher Radio or wherever fine podcasts are found. ESO is also available up on most social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and so many more. The show is brought to you by the fine folks at the ESO Amazon.com eStore, where right from our website you can find all kind of geeky goodness. And if you get something up there, you also help support the station. ESO also has a Zazzle store to buy cool ESO merchandise and such. Show your ESO love with something from Zazzle. To learn more about ESO, our website is esopodcast.com. The show is produced by Calico Productions. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next time on the Earth Station 1 podcast. Peace.
James Bond will return in The Living Daylights.